Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On August 28, 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his iconic and powerful I Have a Dream speech for jobs and freedom at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. 50 years later, it's considered to be one of the greatest speeches of the 20th century. And here is a clip from that speech.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream.
In his new book, The Speech, The Story Behind Martin Luther King's Dream, The Guardian's award-winning columnist Gary Young writes, quote, Martin Luther King delivered many speeches, at least 350 in 1963 alone, but almost everyone, including even his enemies, recognized that speech's reach and resonance. So what was it that made that speech historical? And why today, 50 years later, do we still remember it? How do we remember it? And what have we chosen to forget? How far have we come to realize the dream that Dr. Martin Luther King so eloquently articulated that day? Gary Young is an author, broadcaster, and award-winning columnist for The Guardian, based in Chicago. He also writes a monthly column, Beneath the Radar, for The Nation magazine. He's the Alfred Nobler Fellow for The Nation Institute, and he has written three books. Gary has lived in the States for 10 years, and he joins me here in studio. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Ross.
Nice to meet you in person.
Thank you.
So, it's so interesting. In your introduction, Lightning in a Bottle, you write that the night before the march on Washington in 1963, Martin Luther King asked his aides for advice about the speech he was due to make the next day, and Wyatt Walker told him, quote, don't use the lines about I have a dream. It's trite, it's cliche. You've used it too many times already.
Yeah, that was the... It wasn't the only advice he got, but it was part of the advice. He'd used it in Detroit 3 months earlier. He'd used it in Chicago just a week earlier. If you're giving 350 speeches in a year, you're drawing together a number of refrains, as preachers do. And the feeling from Wyatt T. Walker, and I also think Andrew Young, was, you know, this has to be on a par with Gettysburg. This is your introduction to the nation. If you were in the black church or the civil rights movement, you'd heard King before. But if you weren't, you hadn't. And the cameras were going to be on him that day. And they wanted him to raise his game. And they thought the I Have a Dream thing was just going to be a bit too ticky-tacky for the occasion. And it wasn't in the text of the speech. I mean, when he went up to the podium, as far as we know, he had no idea. He wasn't planning to say it.
And Wyatt Walker was a chief strategist for Dr. King and a religious leader.
That's right.
Talk a little bit about the woman who at the speech was saying, talk about the dream, talk about the dream.
Right. So it's Mahalia Jackson, who's King's favorite gospel singer. Now, no women addressed the march from the platform that day, which was itself controversial, but some did sing. And Mahalia Jackson had sung before King. She'd sung, I've been buked, I've been scorned. And she was, King would call her for what they called gospel therapy. When he was down and on the road, he would call Mahalia Jackson and she would sing to him. He would ask her to sing various songs. And so there was an intimate relationship there. She had seen him do the I Have a Dream thing in Detroit a few months earlier. And so he's coming. If you listen to the speech, he's winding up. He says, go back to Mississippi. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to your northern homes and ghettos. And she shouts, tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream. And, you know, he continues, knowing that in some way this situation will be resolved. And then she shouts again, tell him about the dream, tell him about the dream. And in the words of Clarence Jones, who wrote the draft of the speech and was standing nearby, at that point King put the text to his left, and in his body language turned from a lecturer to a preacher. And then Jones turned to the person standing next to him and said, "Those people don't know it, but they're about to go to church."
Well, and I love that you write about what you call the chauvinism of the movement, and we'll talk about that later in the show. But here we are 50 years later, and you can bet that in a couple of weeks, because the 50-year anniversary on August 28th, we're going to hear "I Have a Dream" over and over and over again.
Oh, yes, yes.
And you have, for writing this book, over the past 16 years, you've conducted interviews with a range of civil rights leaders, activists, and others. Why did you decide to write this book?
Well, it's always intrigued me the way that, given what I know about how unpopular King was at certain points when he was alive, how the country has managed to sanitize the speech or to make it possible that nobody in their right mind would now denounce this speech. Everybody loves this speech. And yet, when he gave this speech, that was not the case. And the man who gave this speech would spend the next 5 years becoming more and more marginalized. So it's always intrigued me the way that history chooses. History doesn't just choose the best speech. It sifts things with great prejudice. So what is it that this country needs from that speech that it's chosen to remember and revere it in the way that it has, to the point where two-thirds of Americans love the speech.
And it's even cited by hardcore conservatives.
Right. I mean, on Glenn Beck, when he has his demonstration in Washington, restoring honor or whatever it is, he claims the speech. It's on the day of the speech. This man had a dream. When people attack affirmative action, they use the speech. Ronald Reagan, who at a different point said, when asked, "Well, do you still think that King was a communist?" he said, "Well, we'll know in 35 years, won't we?" But still would quote the dream speech. So Barack Obama, when he takes the Democratic nomination in 2008, does it on the anniversary, the 45th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech, but fairly typically, I think, doesn't mention King by name. So everybody wants a piece of this speech, and not just locally, but globally.
Right. What I love about your book is there's so many tidbits in here that I learned things like Rosa Parks and Maya Angelou were actually sympathetic to Malcolm X's message about violence. Mm. You write about John F. Kennedy and what went on behind the scenes. There's just so many great tidbits. And I'm wondering, what did you learn throughout this process that you didn't know before?
A few things. I didn't realize that 1963 was such a pivotal year, and that within that year, Birmingham was such a pivotal moment. It wasn't obvious to me how close things came to getting completely out of control. That everybody, the Southern segregationists, the civil rights leadership, Kennedy, they're all trying to catch up with events. And I think in the book I quote Hannah Arendt as saying, revolutionaries don't actually start revolutions, they pick them up in the street. And this is what happens in this moment. So I would say that was one of the main things. And the other was the intense rivalry within the Civil Rights Coalition. The kind of meanness. They're like, you know, mean girls, but they're kind of 40-year-old men, and they are sniping at each other. And Roy Wilkins calls King a political idiot. There is real antipathy and ambivalence about Bayard Rustin, who's openly gay, and a former communist organizing the march. And that was also interesting, the way in which these church people, including King, rally around Rustin and defend him from attacks from conservatives outside and inside the movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, even inside the movement. Mm. You write that on the freedom rides, everybody had to go through kind of a test to make sure that they were not gay or they were not communist, because they didn't want to give, you know, the other side anything to work with.
Well, that's right. There is this, we have this sense of the civil rights movement as only being a deeply moral movement, which it was. But it was also incredibly strategic and political. And so calculations were being made like that all the time. So one of the favourite interviews, one of my favourite interviews I've ever done was with Claudette Colvin, who was a 15-year-old in Montgomery who was kicked off the bus before Rosa Parks. They started to run with her. She has letters from people as far afield as Seattle urging her on, and then she gets pregnant. She's very dark, she's from the wrong side of town, and they drop her like a hot potato because they decide we can't win with her. Then Rosa Parks, who was being kicked off buses left, right and centre, the woman was a menace. I mean, she was, you know, fantastic. Rosa Parks gets kicked off the bus, and King, in the first speech at Dexter Baptist Church, says, if it had to be someone, then let it be Rosa Parks. Well, it didn't have to be Rosa Parks. It could have been Claudette Colvin. But they decided to... So these are very strategic people we're talking about. So the whole time, they're thinking, what do we have to do? But they're also thinking, how is this going to look? And so people are getting cast aside left, right and centre. Bayard Rustin made it. I mean, he was marginalised historically, but he's the man who organised the march. And I don't think there's anybody who knows the history of that march well who thinks that it could have been pulled off without his genius.
Well, so you just brought up a lot of things there. So Rosa Parks, I just want to bring this up quickly. You write, an ostensibly demure icon of the movement met Malcolm X shortly before his assassination in February of 65 and stated afterwards that her philosophy was closer to his than to King's. Did you know that before going into this?
I knew that before going into this, just because of the piece I'd done on Claudette Colvin demanded kind of stripping away the myths about Rosa Parks also.
Quote, Dr. King used to say that black people should receive brutality with love, and I believe that was a goal to work for, but I couldn't reach that point in my mind at all. Malcolm wasn't a supporter of nonviolence either.
I mean, it's interesting the way that Parks is, you know, depicted as this little old lady, you know, she had a very sophisticated political analysis, but it's also true that in that time, large numbers of people who were involved in the movement were not convinced by nonviolence. I mean, they understood it as a strategy, but Joan Baez, who I interviewed the book, says, you know, the thing about nonviolence is you don't know that you won't get killed. You know you won't kill someone else, but you don't know that you won't get killed. And when people are raining down on you with baseball bats and with lead piping and dogs and hoses...
And hosing your children,
then nonviolence as a strategy may make more sense than as a principle. And so one of the challenges of the civil rights movement throughout in this period was, how do we keep a lid on this? How do we stop it getting violent? Because strategically, they thought, once it gets violent, we lose.
But they were really smart, because you write that in many ways, it was sort of an unwritten contract between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, because they knew that the establishment would say, well, the face of the black movement is not Malcolm X, it's Martin Luther King Jr., because he has a nonviolent dream.
That's right. I mean, Malcolm X used to say, if you don't deal with him, you'll have to deal with me. And the night before the march, Malcolm X is in D.C. that day, and he's roaming around the lobby of the Statler Hotel, poking fun at people who are coming to the march, saying, oh, you're all going to a picnic and you're all wasting your time. But then that night, he goes to the home of... hotel room of Ossie Davis, the late actor, and he says to him, if you need me, I am here. I am here. And by which I think he means, if you need troubled waters calming, if you need a... You know, there are people... If things get out of hand, there are some people who may listen to me who won't listen to Martin in that moment. I am here. Because he understood, even though he wouldn't have called the march himself, even though he didn't go on the march, that... If the march was a failure, that would set everybody back, and it needed to be a success on its own terms.
We're speaking with Gary Young about his new book, The Speech, the story behind Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream. Gary is an award-winning columnist with The Guardian, based in Chicago. He's lived in the States for 10 years. He also writes a monthly column, Beneath the Radar, for The Nation magazine. And today we are talking about one of the most iconic speeches of our time. On August 28, 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King gave the speech at the end of a very hot day. A lot of people, actually, there was a controversy over when to have him speak.
Mm.
A lot of people wanted him to speak at the end because they thought the networks would go home, but they didn't. They actually broadcast it live across the country. So what is it about this speech? Why do you think this one is remembered the most? A lot of historians say that the speech he gave at Riverside about the Vietnam War and the U.S. being the greatest purveyor of violence in the world was actually his best speech. So what is it about this one? What do you remember? And what do we remember? What have we chosen to forget? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We'll also talk about where we were back then and where we are today. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What do you remember about that speech? And you can leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So let's just put all of this in context. I think this one area in your book, The Moment, you do a really good job with this. You say, you talk about the divisions that people had behind the scenes and the strains on the strategy of nonviolence would be compounded by the brutal unraveling of the decade. Kennedy was shot dead just a few months after the march. Malcolm X was assassinated in 65. In 68, both King and Bobby Kennedy were gunned down. And as the Vietnam War escalated and the draft was expanded, an entire generation would be trained and brutalized in violence. Watts went up in flames in 1965. 2 years later, tanks rolled through Detroit's residential areas to quell riots. King's assassination at a motel in Memphis sparked disturbances throughout the country.
Right.
That's intense.
Yes. I mean, it is a remarkable 5 years that takes place it's a remarkable decade, actually, if you start in February 1st, 1960, with Franklin McCain and the three other kids sitting down in the Woolworths in Greensboro and challenging the segregation, and you go to the end of that decade. It was a very violent decade and a very tricky decade in which to espouse nonviolence, because most of the key players in this story are murdered before within 5 years, and most of the key issues are not resolved but dealt with. So Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, there are some major victories in that moment, but what comes after is a kind of real, by the end of that decade, the center of gravity of black politics has shifted from the South to the North, from the rural to the urban, from kind of from the gospel to Mao's Little Red Book, and rather than talk about integration, people are talking about black power. Everything changes, and that speech really comes at this pivotal moment and articulates both a deep frustration and hurt, but also, and this is rare for a speech about race, a real optimism and a utopianism, which is what I love about it. And it manages to match them both. Things are bad, but things can be so much better.
Right. And you also write that there were struggles with the speeches themselves, and a lot of people were pressured not to go too far.
Right. And particularly John Lewis, who I think is the only person still alive who spoke that day, right up until the moment when he comes to the podium, there is an ad hoc committee is set up to kind of basically go through his speech and say, you can't say that, you can't say that, you can't say that. Because if he does say certain things, then Archbishop O'Boyle is going to pull out and Kennedy's going to do this. And so the negotiations take place right until the end. And what they represent is a real generational shift in the movement between the older people from the NAACP who believe that legal and legislative strategies are the only way to go. And then you have King with his direct action in the middle, really. And then the youngsters, John Lewis being one of them, who are out there in Mississippi, their friends being killed and being beaten and so on, who say, and John Lewis said behind the, they have this negotiation behind the monument, and he turns to, I think it's Roy Wilkins, and he says, we're down there, we know, you don't.
We're speaking with Gary Young about his book, The Speech, and you can join us, 866-798-8255. What do you remember about the I Have a Dream speech? And just that time, I mean, so many events, seminal events happened back then. And if you have any connections to Birmingham, Alabama, or you're from there, we'd love to hear from you. Do you think people realize just how important Birmingham, Alabama was at that time?
I must say I didn't. I mean, I knew it was a big thing, but I considered it one of the many big things that happened that time. You know, there was Birmingham, there was the Freedom Rides, there was the Mississippi Freedom Summer, and I considered it as part of that continuum. What I didn't realize until I wrote the book was that it was after Birmingham that everything changed. I think before Birmingham, 4% of Americans thought that civil rights was a major issue. Afterwards, it was 54. The New York Times covered more pieces about civil rights in the 2 months after Birmingham than they did in something like the 4 years before. Everything changed. And also, because of the capacity of television to broadcast and beam across the world, it wasn't just a national issue. It was on the front page of Pravda. It was a stick that the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc were beating America with. It was a rallying cry for anti-colonial movements all around the world. And Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, in an interview, he says, our enemies are gleeful, our allies are embarrassed. And he's talking about trying to sell America to the rest of the world and sell the concept of American freedom and American democracy at a time when what people are seeing about America is dogs and hoses on children.
Hmm. Let's hear from Ron in San Francisco. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Once again, I want to applaud you. It's a tremendous show. You always are right on top of everything, a tremendous dialogue.
Thank you.
I want to commend your speaker, too, because he raises some very salient issues that a lot of people through the years have forgotten. One of the things I want to highlight is, and it's what you were saying earlier, and it's really interesting. You know, back in the time, no one really, except for real activists, cared what Martin Luther King was really doing, and the fact that people were being beaten and dogs and people being hosed down south, and you had a lot of American Jews from the north that, you know, left the comfort of their own home and sacrificed their lives and went down there to, you know, for the rights of these people. But no one cared what King was doing until people like Stokely Carmichael, H.R.R. Brown, Huey Newton started talking about a different kind of resistance that King really started to get traction. It wasn't until that happened, when people saw those images with Walter Cronkite on CBS News of people getting hosed, and, you know, at that time I was a, you know, relatively young man, and we were not going to play that. And that's when he started gaining traction. What I remember specifically about the I Have a Dream speech, because I'm an indigenous New Yorker, and I lived in Harlem at the time, was that the Michelle Black Bookstore, which had existed there for years, kept playing that speech over and over again when King is assassinated. And that speech and Michelle's playing that speech over and over again is what ignited the riots in Harlem. I was there. I'm not talking about something I read at the New York Times or that I saw in the news. I was there. I was one of the kids there. It was really, really a very, I don't know how to describe it. It was just a moment. Hmm. A moment in history. You'll never forget it.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Ron. A quick response, Gary, before we go to break.
Well, that's right. I mean, in Birmingham, at the end of the children's demonstrations, the Klan bombs a motel. And after they bomb this motel, there is a violent response. In a 16-block radius, cars are burned, people confront the police. And it's at that point that Kennedy decides we are going to have to do something. It's the violence that pushes him to the edge.
We're speaking with Gary Young, author of The Speech, The Story Behind Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Dream, and we'd love to hear from you. What do you remember about that time? And what do we choose to remember about this speech? We're going to hear a lot of it over the next few weeks. And what do we choose to forget? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll discuss coverage of Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post. He's definitely not the first billionaire adding media properties to his portfolio. So what does this mean for the future of journalism? How will the Washington Post cover everything from Amazon to independent bookstores to working conditions? Such a wide range of issues there. And then we're also going to talk about coverage of U.S.-Russia relations after Edward Snowden was granted asylum. That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Gary Young about his new book, The Speech, the story behind Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream. Gary is a columnist with The Guardian. He also writes a monthly column, Beneath the Radar, for The Nation magazine. And he's lived in the States for 10 years. He's living in Chicago. And we'd love to hear from you. Over the next couple weeks, we're going to hear the speech, I Have a Dream, specifically from MSNBC to Fox News and everything in between. And so why do you think this speech is still remembered today and will most likely be remembered in 50 years? What do you remember about this time in history? Where were we back then and where are we today? And the other important question, we'll talk about this, is what do we choose to forget about this movement? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. You know what I find it's so interesting? We did a show about Nelson Mandela a couple weeks ago. And you think about people like Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King. I'll throw a woman in there, Gloria Steinem from the women's movement. And I think about like the Occupy movement and how they were very much opposed to working within the system, but also opposed to having a, quote, leader. And I wonder what you think about that.
I think it generally depends on the moment, you know, and that kind of... I mean, when King, when, say, Mandela, I spent quite a lot of time in South Africa. It's actually where I started journalistically. He didn't want to be, the ANC decided, you know what, we're going to make you the central part of the campaign. This would have been in the late 70s. He didn't want that. And, you know, he said, oh, it's going to be kind of hero worship and so on. And they said, no, the fact that you're in jail and we're in exile... makes the point perfectly. And so he acceded to it on that basis. But he was always deeply uncomfortable with being revered in the way that he was. And there are times when you need a leader, I think, and there are times when you need a movement. And those two things can coexist. But quite often, and if we think about, for example, King and X and the conversation that we were having earlier about these assassinations, that quite often when the leaders died, their movements died with them because they were leader-centered. There wasn't a whole lot of... It wasn't like there was any democratic control over King. He did what he did and he was good at what he did. But... the way in which they are kind of those organizations were top heavy did become something of a liability. Whereas, say, the NAACP does have any town that you go to, there is an NAACP pretty much, and you can call them. And they're increasingly, they might be older, you might not agree with everything they say, but they exist in a way that the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, doesn't really. And so. For all of the ways in which these were brilliant men, and they were nearly always men,
right. There
was a problem there in the kind of messianic, demagogic is the wrong word, but a very messianic zeal that they personified that meant that you either followed the leader or you left, and when the leader went, so did the movement.
Because I wonder, I mean, we're at a time in history right now where I read the obituary section regularly because we're losing so many incredible activists. A lot of these activists I've never heard of. And in 10 or 15 years, they'll all be gone for the most part.
Yeah.
And then what? I wonder, what will we remember about this time in 50 years?
Yes, I mean, it's... And in a way, that the book is part of that because there is this contest, I think, always with history to reshape it and to re-describe it and to make out now like everybody loved Martin Luther King. Well, they didn't, actually. He was quite unpopular when he died. He died a kind of somewhat marginal figure supporting garbage workers in Tennessee, with people saying he's all washed up. But it suits a large number of people to say, well, you know, we always loved Martin Luther King. That was always great. Just as in South Africa, you can't find anybody in South Africa now who supported apartheid. But obviously they did. And so there is always this contest with history to say, well, actually, you know what? It didn't really happen like that. And I was interviewing Eduardo Galeano, the Uruguayan writer, recently. And I said, so who is this person, this thing that's trying to mess around with history? And he said, well, it's not a person, but it's power. And power would like to craft a seamless transition, that we got here by our own genius. And we didn't. We got here through tough struggles. Mm-hmm. And that's useful, because when you look at the people, say, who are opposing immigrant rights now or gay rights now, you can locate them historically and say, yes, we've been history. I think it was Mark Twain who said, history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it does rhyme. Mm-hmm. And so, okay, I haven't seen you before, but we've seen this before.
Also, and I'm going to get to calls in just a minute, but when you look at like gay rights or immigrant rights, within that movement, you can find 10 additional causes, right? Whereas back then, segregation was the word. And then after the March on Washington speech, Martin Luther King started talking about jobs and poverty. Mm. I mean, obviously he talked about that throughout, but segregation was the issue, right?
Yes, And I think that that is one of the key reasons, and I'll throw this out there to your listeners, as to why the speech is remembered in the way that it was, has been remembered in the way that it has. Very quickly, King goes on to talk about poverty, government intervention to relieve poverty, black and white, class, and then he goes on to talk about Vietnam. When he dies, he has to be remembered. America, they try to forget him, and they can't, in a way that they've forgotten. Tried to forget Bayard Rustin and were more successful. He can't be remembered as the man who spoke against American militarism, because that continues. That's contested. That does not put him above the fray. It puts him in the fray. They can't remember him as the man who advocated for government intervention on poverty, because we're still talking about that. But this is a moment, I think, the last great moral achievement of this country for which there's a consensus was getting rid of segregation. And so the speech is lauded as the most eloquent articulation of that moment.
Denise in San Francisco writes, Reverend King's more powerful and relevant speech indicting America's political policies was given at the Riverside Church in New York and is rarely, if ever, mentioned publicly. It is possible that this led to his killing, she writes. In that speech, Vietnam was the topic, and saying that the U.S. is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world.
But here's the thing, is to ask, well, why don't we remember that, one has to look at what we're doing now. And in a moment now with Iraq and Afghanistan and drones and kill lists, there isn't a big enough market to remember that, unfortunately. These are still open wounds. And remembering King as the man who stood against segregation gives almost everybody in America something to feel good about, even those people who supported segregation at the time.
That's Gary Young, author of the new book, The Speech, The Story Behind Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Dream. Gary is a columnist with The Guardian. And let's hear from, Rodessa Jones, one of my favorite artists in San Francisco. Hi, Rodessa. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. Thank you for the show. Thank you so much. Listening, I still get chills just thinking about that day. I was only in eighth grade, but I remember sitting with my parents. We all were sitting and watching television, and first of all, it was an amazing event for television. Mm. And Martin Luther King had been such a voice of hope, which is nothing new to say, but being that I was from a migrant family, and my mother and father had already suffered such incredible strife and abuse in the South. My mother had literally seen lynchings where she had been taken with her family to see people lynched as a young girl. And here was Martin Luther King being able to articulate where we were at and what was possible, and the whole idea of the dream. You know, I just remember feeling like there was hope for us all, and that my mother and father may very well be able to lay their burdens down with this man who was able to stand there and speak so eloquently about where we were and what was needed. And now it's so disheartening for me in that everything from the way the Voting Rights, the Voting Act has been just totally desecrated, the death of Trayvon Martin, black-on-black crime, where at this time in history, King was speaking to us as a nation, and I feel like even black folks were doing better then, economically, in a different kind of way, but it is... This is such a bittersweet morning for me, listening to your show and thinking back on. And it also gives me hope as an activist myself that I just have to push on. You know, I have to just move on and continue the work of bettering us as humanity. You know, it's very rich. And just thank you so much for this show.
All right.
Okay? And thank you so much to the writer for the book. And
I will
definitely get it. Okay.
Thank you so much, Rodessa. And just to let you know, Gary, Rodessa Jones runs this incredible cultural odyssey in San Francisco. She does a lot of work with women prisoners in South Africa.
Oh, wow.
And she has women actually on stage telling their own stories.
Well, what Rodessa just said there really reminded me of a quote when I interviewed Andrew Young. And he said about the speech, it would be like if right now in the Arab Spring somebody made a speech that was 15 minutes long that summarized what this whole period of social change was about. The country was in more turmoil than it had been since before the Second World War. People didn't understand it, and he explained it. It wasn't a black speech. It wasn't a Christian speech. It was an all-American speech. And then, and this is me talking about kind of how America came by King and comparing it to South Africa. And I say, so white America came to embrace King in the same way that most white South Africans came to accept Nelson Mandela, grudgingly and gratefully, retrospectively, selectively, without grace, but with considerable guile. By the time they realized their dislike of him was spent and futile, he'd created a world in which admiring him was in their own self-interest, because in short, they had no choice.
Hmm. That's Gary Young, author of The Speech, and thank you again, Rodessa. Let's hear next from Ashe in Felton. Hi, Ashe. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you for this show. This is really incredible. I was about 4 or 5 when when Martin Luther King gave the speech, and it seems now that the whole... history of it and memory of it is almost like a little bit whitewashed by the society. And I remember at that time my mom was a civil rights worker and was on the freedom rides. And it was like every time she walked out the house, she might not come back. I remember the air at that time was almost electric, and it was more like, you know, the year after 9/11, when everyone was so deeply, heart ripped open. The 60s was always, there was always going to be, it was like waiting for the next monumental change around the corner and everybody holding their breath. And some of the violence continued, like in the 70s, in 1970 with Kent State. I mean, everybody, there was, the anti-war thing and the breaking out of our chains of segregation, it was connected, and I believe that's why Dr. King was shot. But that's my personal belief.
I mean, they were deeply.
But thank you for this show.
Well, I wanted to ask you: do you remember the speech as a 4 or 5 year old? Do you? I mean, I'm sure you don't remember the quotes, but do you remember anything about that day, or was it kind of told to you kind of quite soon afterwards?
Not specifically about the day. I distinctly remember the night he was shot, and my sister ran up, and everyone was in tears, and it was late, and but through my growth, of course, I learned about the speech and read his work and saw many videos of him. but I think I was connected to it through my mom going down to Alabama, and she was also on the Selma March, and she and my sister, my eldest sister, went with her, and they were kind of completely brutalized. So, but I'm so grateful and thankful for the continuation of something real. Besides the whitewashing.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Ashay. Thanks for calling. Let's go next to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Thank you very much for an excellent program. I enjoy your guests' words. I read him occasionally in the UK Guardian. He does an outstanding job. I was at the University of Wisconsin, a student from Haiti, when I heard this speech. Extraordinary. Mm. I still have the chills about it.
And did it speak to you? Sorry, as you said you were from Haiti.
That's right. I was a student of engineering at the University of Wisconsin when I heard it, and I followed very closely.
So how did it speak to you as a Haitian?
Haiti, we had different problems, of course, at the time. We had the Duvalier dictatorship. But coming from Haiti, we didn't necessarily see things the same way as an African-American, let's put it this way. Intellectually, we understood what was going on. But because of our national experience, we did not understand it the same way at an emotional level. It's a very important point. But I'd like to say that the speech was incredible, the eloquence of the men, the dignity of the whole event. And morally speaking, the speech was impeccable. It appealed to so many people. It made so many people vibrate. But I'd like one more thing. We tend to look at the leaders. Of course, it's true of movements, whatever their orientation. Leaders play an important role. But the more I read about it, the more I realize that it was possible because so many anonymous people participate in this struggle. And unfortunately, perhaps we don't have that much participation today. But that's a different subject. So I'd like to thank you very much, for both of you, for your outstanding job. And as I said, I still have chills.
Thank you, Max. Thank you. There's a great quote in Gary Young's book, The Speech, from John Lewis, who said, quote, about the speech, "We were surrounded by a moving sea of humanity, tens of thousands of people just pouring out of Union Station, filling Constitution Avenue from curb to curb. It was truly awesome, the most incredible thing I'd ever seen in my life. I remember thinking, there goes America."
Yeah.
Talking about chills.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is in the morning, there weren't that many people, and they were afraid that, are people going to show up?
There's a great scene in the morning where Bayard Rustin comes out very early onto the mall, and there are very few people there. He's actually, there are more kind of security people and journalists than there are protesters. And journalists come up to him and they say, you know, what if it's a failure? How about that? You know, what are you going to do? And Rustin, who's always theatrical, takes out his pocket watch and takes out his piece of paper, looks at the watch, looks at the paper, and he says, "Everything, gentlemen, is right on schedule." And then it turns out later that the paper was completely blank.
Mm-hmm. Talk just quickly about the crowd. 20% of the crowd was made up of whites, and people traveled from all across the country to get there. You've got a story of one guy going on skates, two guys biking.
Yeah. I mean, people got there however they could. Buses came from California. The stars came in a couple of chartered flights from Hollywood, it was quite rare at that time to have a multiracial march. If you're in the South, there would be a handful of whites, but even they were hoping for a third white. But 20% white in a city like DC, which is overwhelmingly black, was still not bad, and it was remarked on by a large number of people because it looked like a possible future. It looked like a possible future in which black people and white people could walk together for the same end. And people, one forgets now all too easily that people hadn't really seen that before.
You also write that the celebrities were told by the FBI to stay in their hotel rooms.
Yeah.
And then George Rockwell, the leader of the U.S. Nazi Party, vowed to bring 10,000 white supremacists to the march, but over 70 showed up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, completely pathetic. I mean, they tried in all sorts of ways to provoke And it just didn't work. And when Bayard Rustin is negotiating, because the big concern about this demonstration was that there would be violence, mm-hmm. and they treated it like a military operation. It was actually called Operation Steep Hill. 1,000 troops stationed just outside the city, 30 helicopters, 19,000 more troops on standby, ready to fly up from North Carolina and drop into the mall at a moment's notice. And Bayard Rustin explains to them, he says, look, the violence that we see in the South is provoked not by black people, but by white segregationists. If you really want to stop the violence, stop them.
Mm. Well, and President Kennedy was almost begging for them not to have this march.
That's right. He says, we want legislation. We don't want a big show. We don't want the Negroes in the streets. And A. Philip Randolph says to him, Mr. President, the Negroes are already in the streets. The question is whether we could, whether if I asked for them to come back, whether they would.
I also love that you write about the fact that the leaders were not at the march yet and people already started marching. And they said, wait a minute, we're not there yet. And so they were in the middle of the march.
Yeah, which metaphorically is kind of it's a wonderful metaphor for that year, really. Mm. The leaders go to Congress to talk to senators and Congress people about their demands. It's all kind of very convivial, tea and biscuits kind of thing. And then they come out and get in their limos to go to the march. And it's a very hot day. And people have just started to march already. So their limos get caught in the crowd. And they think, damn, what are we going to do? So they jump out of their limos. And I think it's Bayard Rustin. He says, but they're supposed to be following us. And so what they do is they rush into the middle of the crowd and clear a space. And the pictures that you see of King and Randolph locking arms is actually them in the middle of the demonstration. They never got to lead the demonstration because the people went without them.
Well, we've got a few more minutes to take some calls with Gary Young, author of The Speech. And let's go to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, yes. I was wondering, Gary, what your opinion is about current poverty and injustice in the United States. I know you've written extensively about that, including recently the Chicago school situation, compared to back then. Do you think things have improved dramatically, or do you think that things have gotten worse?
Well, very quickly, it's a big question, but I do think that I think both. I think things have improved considerably, and that unfortunately, we are, even though things have improved broadly, we're more or less in the same place. Back in 63, during the march, black unemployment was twice the level of white unemployment. It still is. Mm. The median income disparity is pretty much the same. The signs have come down, and the rhetoric and symbolism has changed. But substantially, I think in 63, there wasn't the jail population of African Americans that we have now. And so racism has become a far more complex and kind of hydra-headed thing to fight. And whereas you could focus then on segregation, and there were movements to do that, now the focus is more dispersed, and the movements don't exist in quite the same way. And finally, if you look at what's going on in the Supreme Court, many of the achievements of that time are being stripped away. If you look at the Voting Rights Act or affirmative action, that kind of thing, are being gutted.
Well, because you write a column about all of the issues that we're facing today, and there are just so many, I mean, what are your thoughts on what movements can learn from that time?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question.
It's a tough one.
Yeah. Well, and one has to be the pragmatism that is involved in coalition building. That every step of the way in organizing this march, it involves concessions, and for those concessions, you get other things. Now, you never want to concede too much, but the idea that you don't concede anything is unsustainable.
Do you think that groups are conceding too much with President Obama in office? I mean, because you know they'd be protesting a lot of these issues if it were a Republican.
Yeah. I mean, my feeling about President Obama is that beyond the symbolism of him being the first black president, it's important to actually treat him like any other president, to make the demands that you're going to make. It really worries me when African Americans say, we shouldn't be asking for special things. He's the president of all America. And I think you are part of the whole America. So these aren't special things. These are things you would demand regardless of who's in power. And it saddens me when people decide to mute their voice because they feel it would embarrass the powerful. The moment in which he stepped from being a candidate to being the president, I thought people should take off the badge that says hope with his face on it and put on the badge that says power. He represents power. And if anyone, Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. Obama understood that as a community organizer when he was lobbying Harold Washington in Chicago, the first black mayor, and people should understand that about him now.
And 30 seconds, Gary, I mean, when you look at just where we've been over the last 50 years, again, when you apply what happened back then to what we're facing today, I mean, what keeps you kind of hopeful writing this column, you know, every week?
Because there are people out there who are still fighting, who are still doing it. And in the same way that history doesn't quite record the speech in the way that it should, not all of their efforts are recorded in the way that it should be. But none of this stuff happens by accident. The Dream Act people, the Trayvon Martin protesters, people are out there. There's a homelessness about these movements. They shift from Occupy Wall Street to Trayvon Martin to this and that. But they are out there in exactly the same way that they were then, fighting for different things and the same thing. The same thing is justice, but what justice means at a different moment, at a different time, in a different place, that keeps changing.
Gary Young is author of The Speech, the story behind Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream. He's a columnist with The Guardian. He'll be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Redstone Building in San Francisco. Gary, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post. He's not the first billionaire adding media properties to his portfolio. So what does this trend mean for the future of journalism? We'll also talk about U.S.-Russia relations after Edward Snowden was granted asylum. We'll be joined by the Seattle Times' Jay Green, The Nation's John Nichols, and the Christian Science Monitor's Fred Weir. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.